Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that share Mazda's passion that cars make driving matter. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. In 1865, near the end of the Civil War, President Abraham Lincoln made a promise to the thousands of people he freed through the Emancipation Proclamation and the South's defeat. Each was to receive 40 acres and a mule to help them establish a foothold in a social and economic structure in which they would have to fend for themselves. The United States never made good on that promise. Following Lincoln's assassination, his successor, Andrew Johnson, a known white supremacist and Southern sympathizer, returned those 40 acres to former slave owners. Ever since, there have been periodic calls for reparations for African Americans that never seem to gain traction. It isn't as though we haven't done this before. We have. Reparations were made to American natives and to the Japanese, in turn, during World War II. Well, the topic has resurfaced amid the ongoing protests over the killing of George Floyd and in the middle of a pandemic that is having an inordinately negative impact on African Americans. That makes this a good time to investigate the topic with one of the nation's leading scholars. Dr. William Darity is a professor of public policy in the Sanford School of Public Policy and professor of African and African American studies and of economics, all at Duke University. He is also the co-author of the book From Here to Equality, Black Reparations in the 21st Century, and he joins us now from Durham. Welcome back to the program, Doctor. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
The discussions of reparations have, as I said, been on again, off again for centuries now, it seems, and there's always a disagreement on whether or not we should do it, which we will talk about that, and then how we should do it, which we will also talk about. But do you think that now, as we are well set into the 21st century, that there's any meaningful disagreement over the premise of your book, which is that racism and discrimination have choked economic opportunity for African Americans at nearly every turn? Do most people recognize that today?
I believe most people recognize it, but there still is a significant core of Americans who don't accept that premise. And I think that that core is heavily influenced by the strong effects of what I would like to refer to as lost cause ideology, which has infected the way in which we teach our young people about the period of slavery, the period of Reconstruction, the Civil War itself in our nation's schools. I think that that's had a long-term effect on the way in which people think about how race and racism operate in America.
Is that changing at all? Do you know? I know you teach college, not elementary school or junior high school, but is that changing the way we teach that period in our nation's history?
I believe that there is some momentum for significantly changing it. And I think that the fact that people are increasingly talking about how the curriculum has been structured in the past, how it's either said very little about slavery or it's said things that are distortions of the record. I think the mere fact that people are now discussing that opens the door for significant changes. In our book, we refer to this as deconfederatization.
Let's talk about that first. I wasn't planning to talk about that, but I understand what you mean by the concept. But there would be those then that would step forward and say, ah, revisionist history.
Well, all history is revisionist with respect to some previous story that's typically been told. The question is, how accurate and valid is the story that you're telling? And the story that has been told thus far that has been perpetrated largely by the United Daughters of the Confederacy and the Daughters of the American Revolution is one that has given us a false narrative about the American past.
And how did, I understand the Daughters of the American Revolution kind of winning out because we actually beat the British. How did the Daughters of the Confederacy win out when they lost the war?
Well, some people would argue, and I think that there is some accuracy to this, that the Confederacy lost the war, but it didn't lose the ideological battle afterwards. And in fact, it won that ideological battle to the extent that the Confederacy itself has been portrayed as a heroic effort to preserve states' rights and states' integrity instead of acknowledging that the Confederacy was an act of traitorship.
We are going to talk some more about that because that has other tentacles into other things that you are an expert in. Something is happening right now in America, though, in the fight for equal justice, and that and the increasing recognition that Black Lives Matter, and that's all the result of the murder of George Floyd and the ensuing protests that have been going on ever since. And the endurance of those protests is something that is remarkable. But not only that, the makeup of the people who are protesting is different because we now have white people joining in and people of other races joining in on this. Do you think that this will have any effect on opening people's minds and eyes to reparations?
I certainly think it could. I think there's some evidence that it is having such an effect. There's a new poll that was just issued a couple of days ago that indicated, and this is really, really dramatic to the extent that this poll is correct, that about 39% of white Americans are in favor of reparations at this moment. In the year 2000, when a couple of researchers at the University of Chicago took a survey of American opinion on reparations, 4% of white Americans were in favor of Black reparations. About a year and a half ago, when a survey was taken, it was about 15% of white Americans. So to see a survey that says 39% is startling and is suggestive that there is some real promise in this moment.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up because I had figures from the Washington Post reporting, and I'm not sure how old that article was, maybe a year or two, reporting that 74% of African Americans now favor reparations and 85% of whites, as you just referenced, oppose them. But that figure has now been reduced to what? 61% of whites oppose them.
That's stunning. Yeah, if it's correct.
Yeah. Well, yeah, but things are moving rapidly in this area, really rapidly in many areas. And I'm not sure what, maybe it's just time. Maybe it took all that time. Maybe it's the passing of the torch to another generation of people who have grown up differently. Had the promise of 40 acres and a mule been followed through on and realized, do you think racial attitudes and conditions for African Americans today would be substantially different?
So that's a subject for speculative fiction, but I'm a big fan of speculative fiction. So I really have to think that things would be different. I'm not certain exactly how different, but because of the significance of the provision of restitution to the formerly enslaved in the form of these 40-acre land grants, because that was so important and it was denied, I have a sneaking feeling that we would not be talking about reparations in 2020. We would not need to had the 40-acre land grants been made.
But would conditions for African Americans today have been, the reasoning is here that they have been oppressed since they arrived in the country. It didn't really change all that much following the end of the Civil War through Jim Crow and through a lot of rules and regulations and laws that were put in place purposefully to keep them down. Had the 40 acres and a mule given them a start economically?
Oh, no, absolutely. If you come out of slavery with essentially zero wealth and you are given a stake in land as a primary asset, particularly in the latter half of the 19th century, that is an important springboard in terms of your capacity to provide resources for subsequent generations. I would argue that what we observe as an immense racial wealth gap in the United States, where Black Americans constitute about 13% of the nation's population, but only possess about 2.5% of the nation's wealth, that the origins of that huge disparity or gap starts with the failure to provide the formerly enslaved with the 40 acres. So I would think we would have a very different world today had the 4 million formerly enslaved actually received these substantial land grants.
You used the word restitution a moment ago, and the word reparations implies restitution. for a wrong committed. When Abraham Lincoln promised 40 acres and a mule, did he view that as restitution, or did he view that as giving people who suddenly found themselves adrift a foothold in the world and also a way not to be a drag on the economy?
Well, I'm not sure that the drag on the economy issue is at stake, given all of the unpaid labor that these Right. individuals had already devoted to the development of the economy. But I would suspect that Abraham Lincoln had in mind both considerations that you've talked about.
How many times in our history since 1865 has the topic of reparations come up, and have the arguments for and against really changed over that time?
It's my impression that the subject has come up continuously, at least from the perspective of the Black community. I would start with the period before emancipation, where there were long and extended considerations of what you should do on behalf of the formerly enslaved. And the enslaved themselves had very strong ideas about what they wanted to happen after the Civil War ended. When General Sherman reaches the coast of Georgia in Savannah, after his march through the state, he meets with a group of black leaders, the spokesman for whom was a gentleman named Garrison Frazier, who was from North Carolina, actually. And he asked these folks what it is that they want to have happen. And the two priorities that they advance are, first, give us land, and second, leave us alone. Neither of those things happened. So we have, from the very end of the Civil War, very explicit statements on the part of the formerly enslaved about what they desired the world to look like after enslavement was over. And then we move into the latter part of the 19th century, where a woman named Callie House develops a movement to get pension funds for the formerly enslaved. And she acquires upwards of 300,000 signatures from the formerly enslaved in support of her effort. But the federal government was hardly sympathetic, and so they ultimately brought her effort down by using mail fraud charges, the same kinds of charges they subsequently brought against Marcus Garvey. And it's in the Garvey movement that you extend this effort for reparations, which carries over through the work of a woman named Queen Mother Audley Moore, and then into organizations that go by the acronyms NCOBRA and NARC that have pushed the development of legislation for a study commission for reparations. And now, more recently, I think it's a movement that consists of folks who view themselves as the American descendants of slavery in the United States as the chief agents or architects of momentum for reparations.
I'm only going to have about 15 seconds for an answer to this question, but you were on this program about a year ago, before the publication of your book, before the sudden embrace of the Black Lives Matter movement and the emergence of greater understanding toward social justice inequalities. At that time, you said you were more optimistic than you had ever been in your life about the enactment of a reparations program, and that is comprehensive and transformative. Literally, I have 10 seconds here. Do you still feel that way?
I do.
Oh, well, that was short. Dr. William Darity is with us, professor of public policy, African and African American Studies and Economics at Duke, and the co-author of From Here to Equality, Black Reparations in the 21st Century. We'll continue right after this. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to Mazda's focus to ensure every element of a car is designed around the driver. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Dr. William Darity is our guest from Duke University and the co-author with his wife, I believe, of From Here to Equality, Black Reparations in the 21st Century. Am I right about that? Your wife?
my co-author. Yeah, you know, we worked on this together and
Okay,
took us
well,
10 years, but
wow.
here it is.
And you're still together.
We're
So
still together, yes, even in the midst of
Yep.
COVID-19, right?
So one of the principal arguments against reparations is always that no one is alive today, black or white, who was either enslaved or who had anything to do with that horrible institution. But would it be accurate to say that there are people alive today who participated in Jim Crow? There are people and institutions in operation today who actively or that actively participated in suppressing African Americans and their economic success.
Yes, absolutely. In our book, we actually argue that there are three phases of American history that we have to consider from a cumulative standpoint in terms of their impact on living descendants of persons enslaved in the United States. The first is obviously slavery itself. The second is the period of legal segregation in the United States, the Jim Crow period, which included not only legally sanctioned segregation, but also significant numbers of waves of white mob violence that cost black people their lives, destroyed property, or resulted in the appropriation of their property by white Americans. That was also the period in which, while black Americans were denied the 40-acre land grants at the end of the Civil War, white Americans received in large numbers 160-acre land grants in the western part of the United States under the terms of the Homestead Acts. These two events, the denial of restitution to Black Americans, but the provision of these substantial land grants to whites in the western part of the country, is one of the anchor points for the immense racial wealth differentials that we observe today. And then subsequent to the Jim Crow period, we've had ongoing atrocities, mass incarceration, police executions of unarmed blacks, which are you know, the trigger event for the kinds of protests that we've observed recently, and also ongoing discrimination in housing, credit, and employment.
Is that because people have not been educated properly on all of this, or is this willful ignorance, the unwillingness to see the facts as they stand?
I'm hopeful that for many people who are resistant to the idea of reparations, that it's because they have not been fully informed about the nation's past and present. But I'm not certain. I have to hope that because I want to be an optimistic, and I'm a teacher. So I have to believe that if you can give people better information, they will make better decisions about their lives and about the world around them.
So I want to get back to something that you talked about a little earlier, and that is the Daughters of the Confederacy and others who kind of wove the narrative that we have come to believe about the antebellum South and what followed in that period of our history. You say that the North gave in to a lot of the South's demands about how black people could and would be treated. And despite the North winning the war, they gave in because to not do so would have forced the North to leave troops in the South for an extended period of time, and it would also have meant long-lasting division among white people, both North and South, over what happened to African Americans. What does that say about this nation's tortured relationship with race, that after winning a bloody war, the North would capitulate to essentially what the South was fighting to try to save,
So
oppression?
one of the things that we demonstrate in our book is that actually in the immediate aftermath of the Civil War, Southern Americans expected that the world would be changed dramatically in such a way that blacks would be permitted to vote, blacks would be allocated the land and the like. And I think at that moment, they were willing to accept it. But I think that Andrew Johnson's actions gave them a degree of expectation that they could restore the old order that they should never have been permitted to have. And once he opened the door for that, the world reverted to a situation in which the only way in which you could reconcile North and South among white Americans was by suppressing black Americans and continuing their oppression. And so I think it's really critical that we examine the impact of Andrew Johnson's actions on behalf of the former Confederates, because I think that that was a crucial turning point in terms of how the world looks today.
It shows you how fragile the world order is. It turns on just tiny little moment. The assassination of Lincoln was not tiny, but it was an unexpected, unanticipated thing that happened, and it changed the world in the blink of an eye, at least for African Americans and for much of American history. You quote Malcolm X in the book saying, "If you stick a knife in my back 9 inches and pull it out 6 inches, that's not progress. If you pull it out all the way, that's not progress. Progress is healing the wound that the knife blow made." Are you saying that reparations would heal the wound?
Reparations is an act of healing the wound. And that's in contrast with eliminating or stopping atrocities that are continuing, which I think is an essential step. But compensation for the effects of the atrocities is reparations. And that would be the equivalent of healing the wound.
You believe, and we've talked a little bit about this, that there's a direct line between the failure to live up to that promise of 40 acres and a mule to the inequalities in wealth between blacks and whites that have consistently been with us since the beginnings. And that includes the rate of home ownership. It includes the ability to get a bank loan and the rates you pay once you do get that bank loan, educational levels that we witness today. Is it that, or is it the actions that followed reneging on what that promise of 40 acres and a mule would have led to? In other words, it led to Jim Crow. We backed away from the victory and gave it back, and it led to Jim Crow. Was Jim Crow more of an impact than not giving them the 40 acres and a mule?
So I think that the failure to provide 40 acres at the outset really is the foundation for the inequalities that we observe today. But subsequent policies, and all of these are governmental policies. So, I would argue that public policy has created the racial wealth gap, and therefore public policy must be mobilized to eliminate the racial wealth gap. And that's why I'm an advocate of reparations. But public policy produced the origins of the racial wealth gap in the context of the failure to provide the formerly enslaved, even with 40 acres, which would have been one quarter of the allotments that were given to white Americans under the Homestead Acts. But the Homestead Acts were written to include black Americans. It's just that they were never applied or executed in a way in which black Americans were also participants in the benefits of what is essentially a land handout by the federal government. I'm in favor of handouts as long as they go to everybody, but they didn't in that particular case. And so, that's the starting point. But if we think about the 20th century, much of the focus on wealth building, particularly for the middle classes, has been on home ownership. And in the 20th century, there have been public policies that have precluded substantial black access to the opportunity to purchase homes that have equity building opportunities in them. And so we can start with the existence of restrictive covenants. We can move into the period of redlining. We can move into accompanying predatory pricing in credit markets for homes. And then we have to pay close attention to the GI Bill, which was perhaps the most effective mechanism for producing social mobility in the United States in the 20th century, where returning veterans were provided with subsidies for home buying as well as funds to attend college. And what was problematic there is there were sharp discriminatory differences in the application of the GI Bill. So extreme that a very, very small proportion of returning black GIs got benefits from the bill. In the most extreme case, I think in the state of Mississippi, there were only two black returning veterans who received the benefits for home buying subsidies from the GI Bill. So again, there's a set of public policies that supported white wealth accumulation and deprived blacks of the opportunity to do the same.
And the effects of that, linger into today. While black people make up 13% of the population they own, just 2.5% of the nation's wealth. The median wealth of white people in 2016 was 10 times that of blacks. And you point out that even for those black heads of households with a college degree, they have 2/3 of the median net income of white heads of households who never finished high school. Okay. Who never finished high school. How can that be?
The primary reason why you can have that kind of disparity where highly educated blacks have considerably less wealth than less well-educated whites is because the way in which people acquire wealth is primarily through the transmission of resources across generations. Grandparents, parents, shifting resources to the younger generation. And that's a normal process, but it gets choked off, as we say, and from here to equality, in a situation in which parents and grandparents are denied the opportunity to accumulate any wealth themselves. And so to the extent that less well-educated whites or lower income whites have had a greater opportunity to receive an endowment or other resources from their parents and grandparents than younger black Americans, we just perpetuate the racial wealth gap.
So I suppose you could call that soft bigotry, the results of soft bigotry, but then there's the hard bigotry that we're going to talk about for a second here. Over the years since the end of this...
Do you mean soft bigotry in the sense that this is not something that is a conscious or intentional act on the part of people? Because if that's what you mean,
No.
I absolutely agree.
Actually, I meant my meaning was that it was these are policies and procedures that go unnoticed. They're intentional,
yes.
but they bubbled beneath the surface.
They create a framework or a structure that produces the horrible outcome. Yeah.
Right. So let's talk about the hard bigotry, because since the Civil War, we've seen attacks more than you can count on African Americans, lynchings, aside from the lynchings that went on into the 1970s, there was an attack on an entire community in Tulsa, Oklahoma, which is just now coming to light in recent years. And there are a lot of black residents of Tulsa who knew nothing about this. That's how efficient they were at burying the results of that. They burnt an entire community to the ground. The only coup of duly elected officials in the history of the United States occurred when white supremacists overturned the duly elected government of Wilmington, North Carolina, in the late 19th century and ran them off and killed many of them. You point to another blight on North Carolina, the Eugenics Board, which committed genocide against black people from 1958 to 1968. And then, of course, there's the syphilis experiment conducted on sharecroppers in Tuskegee, Alabama, at a time when there was no cure. They were infecting these men with syphilis to see what would happen, and there was no cure. How many other incidents might there be that we don't know about?
Well, you mentioned that Wilmington, North Carolina was the only coup that had ever taken place at the municipal level in the United States, but that's not actually true.
Okay.
In Louisiana, for example, there was a coup that took place in Coushatta shortly after the end of the Civil War. There's a host of these massacres that took place across the United States that resulted in black loss of lives and seizure of black property by white mobsters. I would start with the Louisiana massacres, not only Coushatta, but also in Colfax, Louisiana. In 1898, we have the Wilmington massacre, of course. That's followed by a white riot in Atlanta, which was actively modeled after the Wilmington riot. There's a terrific book by Gregory Mixon on how the architects of the Atlanta riot were in close communication with the architects of the Wilmington riot. In 1910, there was a horrible riot in Slocum, Texas, where a group of ministers appealed to the federal government to intervene. And the federal government said, well, this was all a matter of local authority and local discretion. In 1919, we had the Red Summer, where upwards of 35 of these massacres took place in the United States, ranging from north to south, including communities like Elaine, Arkansas, Washington, D.C., and Chicago, Illinois. And then in 1921, of course, we have the Tulsa Massacre. In 1923, the Rosewood Massacre. This goes on until 1943 in Detroit, Michigan. So there was a tremendous level of white violence that was directed against the black community through mob activity. But there was also the lynchings. And I think people underestimate the extent to which the lynchings themselves were directed at people disproportionately at blacks who might be property owners and whose land was actually taken in the aftermath of their murders.
And these are relatively contemporary, many of these things. They're not ancient history. They went on in many people's lifetimes who are alive today. So we have all these things working together against the success of black people in America, but there are still people who subscribe to the old American aphorism, pick yourself up by your bootstraps, take personal responsibility, make good decisions, work hard, and you will get ahead. You, however, say that...
I say that black people have tried to do all of those things, and with some modicum of success, but there's not the same payoff for black Americans of, you know, doing well in school, working hard, and the like. I mean, one of the other statistics that I think is quite striking is that blacks who are employed on a full-time basis actually have a lower level of median wealth than whites who are unemployed continuously.
And you say that because they have tried to do this and were impeded in the progress of trying to do this, that's not the problem. That's not the cause of where we are today. The problems come from a lack of financial capital. And this is where the idea of reparations comes in. So we're going to talk about that when we come back. Reparations, how it might work, because you have a plan on how it might work and how that money would be distributed and who would get it and where it would come from. Dr. William Darity is our guest, Duke University professor and author of From Here to Equality, Black Reparations in the 21st Century. And we will continue our conversation in just a moment at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Our guest today, Dr. William Darity, Professor of Public Policy, African and African American Studies and Economics at Duke University's School of Public Policy, and the co-author, along with Kirsten Mullen, of From Here to Equality, Black Reparations in the 21st Century. So let's talk about the idea of reparations. It's not the first time this has come up, nor would it be the first time that we have engaged in actually giving out reparations. Native Americans, we gave it to them. We gave $1.5 billion to Japanese Americans who had been interned during World War II. Through the Marshall Plan, we helped ensure that the victims of the Nazi Holocaust in Germany also received reparations for that. And in 1952, West Germany paid 3.45 billion Deutschmarks to Holocaust survivors. So there is precedence. Why hasn't the idea ever caught on when it applies to African Americans?
I think it's primarily a consequence of the way in which Black Americans are treated differently from everyone else due to old-fashioned American white supremacy. And I think that that's one of the reasons why I'm feeling some degree of optimism in the present moment, because I think more and more people are questioning the premises of white supremacy and are beginning to challenge racism. That may make it possible for reparations to be something that gets really serious consideration now. And that would be a different set of circumstances from any that I've experienced in my lifetime.
There was an economic impact and an economic value to enslaved people in the South. In 1860, the value assigned to enslaved men and women was calculated at $3 billion. That was an enormous sum of money back then, and it was more than the value of all the factories and railroads in the country combined at the time. The value of the cotton that these people farmed and picked in 1861 was estimated to be $250 million. Now, all of that money went to white slave and plantation owners, and it was all passed down to descendants. So given that, how do you calculate reparations? Where do you even start?
Well, one approach is, of course, to try to come up with some measure of the amount of time that was stolen from folks who were enslaved, not just the time in which they were at work and received no wages, but also their full day insofar as they were treated as the property of other people. So that's one approach. We think that that's an important way to think about it. We're a little bit concerned that individuals who are living today were not necessarily exposed directly to slavery, and so that may not be the best way to provide compensation for the living descendants of U.S. slavery. Another approach is to set as a baseline to try to measure the present value of the 40 acres that were never provided. But that would not capture all of the subsequent effects that were visited upon black folks by white mob violence, legal segregation in the United States, and ongoing atrocities that we've talked about, like mass incarceration. So what we conclude, and from here to equality, is if we look at the racial wealth differential, which really amounts to approximately $800,000 in net worth on average between black and white households. If we look at the racial wealth differential, we're really capturing the cumulative adverse effects, adverse economic effects of all of these historical factors that come into play, as well as contemporary factors that come into play in denying black Americans the opportunity to accumulate wealth. And so we should try to address that gap directly with the reparations project.
Before we talk more about money, you lay out a plan. And interestingly enough, that plan begins with acknowledgement. You say that reparations begin with the culpable party's admission of responsibility for the atrocity. That culpable party, I take it, would be white people?
The United States government.
The United States government.
Yes.
So what do you say to people whose ancestors came here after slavery, who will have to help foot the bill? What do you say to those who say their ancestors did not participate and may, in fact, not have participated in slavery? In other words, how do you get a whole segment of the population to accept blame and to, as you suggest, enumerate the damages inflicted upon the victims and the advantages appropriated by the culpable?
Insofar as our case for reparations is not exclusively attributable to the harms of slavery, but also includes the atrocities that occurred 155 years subsequent to the end of slavery, individuals who have migrated to the United States since slavery ended clearly have been present in the midst of these subsequent atrocities. But I would also add two things. First, that if you migrate to a country, you essentially migrate to its responsibilities and obligations. We actually say the following in From Here to Equality. We say all those who subsequently migrated to the United States have moved to a country whose contemporary promise of opportunity is anchored in its history of exploitation of black lives. The slave trade and slavery extended their tendrils into every fissure of the American economy, producing a hothouse effect that created vast national wealth. America's economic success was built by the unrelenting enslavement of black people. One can hypothesize a counterfactual chain of events where American economic growth took place without slavery, but this is the actual way in which it all began. And so, so individuals who migrated here after slavery ended are actually beneficiaries of the effects of slavery on the American economy. The final comment I'd like to make is, I think that there's a mistaken view that many, many folks hold when they hear about reparations, that there's some charge of personal or individual guilt, and that money will be taken out of their pockets and handed to Black Americans, when in fact it's the national government that has the obligation to meet the reparations bill. It's the national government that is the culpable party, and that is who should finance reparations.
But it's coming from taxpayers, Black, white, Chinese, whatever, whoever you may be, whatever your nationality or your heritage may be, it's coming from all of us, correct?
I mean, it's not.
We're all taxpayers.
If anything should make that clear, it's the way in which we have financed the CARES Act and other types of responses to the COVID-19 crisis, where significant amounts of federal monies have been allocated, in at least $2.5 trillion, without any increase in anybody's tax rate or taxes. So it's not essential for the federal government, which has a sovereign currency, to increase taxes on anyone to engage in additional expenditure of any type, including potential expenditures on reparations.
But doesn't that lead to inflation?
Well, there you go. That's exactly what I was coming to. I said that the critical barrier to increased federal spending is inflation. And so as a consequence, if you're designing a new expenditure program, any type of expenditure program, you would have to design it in such a way that you minimize the inflation risk. And in From Here to Equality, we actually talk about some ways in which a reparations project could be financed so that you would minimize the risk of inflation.
The next step in your plan is what you call redress, acts of restitution and steps taken to heal the wound. Acts is plural. So what are you suggesting?
Well, in this context, we place a heavy emphasis, as you know, on eliminating racial wealth differences. So that's one of the central acts that must be taken as a form of redress. But we also express a desire for the project of American memory making to be addressed by the reparations project. Kirsten Mullen, my co-author, talks about this notion of dismemory, that is the construction of false memories of the nation's history, and how that needs to be reversed. And it could be reversed under the terms of a reparations project, in the same way in which Japanese American reparations included an education, curriculum, instructional component to make sure that people retained an understanding and a memory of what had occurred during World War II with the unjust incarceration of Japanese Americans. Similarly, we could have a curriculum and instruction project for the nation's history, particularly with respect to slavery, the Civil War, and the Reconstruction era.
Just as you have said, not everybody can trace their lineage back to their ancestors who may have held slaves. Not every Black person can trace their lineage back to someone who was enslaved. But you have, it does begin there, and it goes to Jim Crow, which is a different form of slavery. But you have two criteria for reparations for eligibility, two criteria for eligibility for reparations. So what are they? Wow. Couldn't get that out.
So I don't think I've ever said that people cannot trace their lineage back to slave ownership or to enslavement. I think it can be done for virtually everyone with the expertise of well-trained genealogists. And in fact, in our book, we actually argue that the federal government should make genealogical services available to Black Americans who are applying for reparations to support their claims. So we talk about two criteria. The first is what we refer to as a lineage criteria, which connects directly with what you're talking about with respect to genealogy. And that is an individual claimant would have to demonstrate that he or she had at least one ancestor who was enslaved in the United States. And then the second criterion is what we call an identity standard, where for at least 12 years before the enactment of a reparations program or the enactment of a study commission for reparations, an individual would have to demonstrate that they self-identified as Black, Negro, or African American on an official document.
You also put a beginning date on eligibility criteria. You suggest that reparations should go from the start of the Republic, not the colonial period. So the starting date would be 1776 and not 1619. Why?
Insofar as the culpable party is the United States government, the United States government didn't exist in 1619. And you have a very complicated kind of claim that you would have to make against a variety of colonial powers. If somebody wants to develop that claim, I have no objection whatsoever. But it's not the claim that we make in From Here to Equality. Our focus is specifically on the history of the United States as a nation, and on the injustices that have been imposed during the course of that history.
President Obama was, at one point, opposed to reparations. I think he called them impractical. I don't know if he's changed his mind on that. 11 of the Democrats who were earlier running for the presidential nomination this time around supported the bill that appeared several years ago and kind of appears perennially in the Congress but never makes any headway, that would provide reparations or would provide for the establishment of a committee to study reparations. Joe Biden, at the time earlier in the campaign, did not fall into the group of candidates who supported reparations. Does he now?
I don't believe so. I don't think he does.
And how might that impact his support in the Black community, upon which he will have to depend heavily if he wishes to be elected?
I'm not certain about that. I know that despite his refusal to endorse reparations, he had a tremendous amount of support from Black voters in South Carolina in the primary. And in fact, one could argue that it was their votes that saved his presidential candidacy.
Right.
So I'm not sure that it will make much difference. It certainly didn't affect support for Barack Obama. It has affected my personal support. I was invited to be part of the task force that was going to design the racial equity plan, the joint task force between the Sanders wing of the party and the Biden wing of the party. And I refused to participate because Biden has not indicated any degree of support for Black reparations. I'd also like to add that the piece of legislation that other candidates endorsed, H.R. 40, for a study commission for reparations, is probably an excellent idea, especially given that there was a study commission that preceded Japanese-American reparations, the Commission on Wartime Relocation, and the Internment of Civilians. However, I think that H.R. 40, as it is currently written, has a severe set of problems, and I think it must be revised or replaced.
So the third step in your plan for reparations is closure, and you say that constitutes an agreement by both the victims and the perpetrators that the account is settled. I have 15 seconds. How do you achieve that?
You achieve that by achieving an adequate program of redress so that both parties can agree that the bill has been paid.
We could continue this conversation well into the next hour, and perhaps we'll have a chance to explore it more in a future program. Dr. William Darity, the author, a co-author of From Here to Equality, Black Reparations in the 21st Century. Thank you for the hour. Appreciate it. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to those who believe a car should stir one's emotions and deliver a heightened state of driving. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.